This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Good evening, this is Jerry Clinton welcoming you to Night Transmissions number 64. Our first story tonight comes from June the 13th of 1948, where we have a run-in with, well, the unexpected. The Unexpected was a 15-minute series of strange little stories that ended always with a twist. Tonight's show showcases Marjorie Reardon, who was a fairly well-known screen actress of the time, whose character on the lark has an astrologer, a Mr. Erend, do up her chart. It's just for fun. But there's death in them dark hearts.
From Hollywood, Miss Marjorie Reardon in The Unexpected. Life is filled with the unexpected. Romantic, tragic, and mysterious endings to our most ordinary actions. Dreams come true, or dreams are shattered by sudden twists of fate in The Unexpected. And now, Miss Marjorie Reardon, outstanding motion picture and stage star in Horoscope, a drama of the unexpected.
I didn't mean to kill him. Not really. But I knew it was going to happen. The horoscope had told me. Yes, everything started with that fantastic horoscope.
Life is written in the stars, madame, and there are no secrets if one is willing to read.
Can you really tell the future, Mr. Erend? I'm only interested in that. I want to know what is going to happen.
In the heavens, there is no future and no past. The stars know no time, no yesterday, no tomorrow.
But I thought that you...
Yes, you are expecting predictions, madame, but I do not predict. I can only reveal the journeys that our planets indicate. Part of these journeys has already passed. Part is ahead, and you must differentiate.
Well, I'm afraid I don't understand.
It is quite simple. I will interpret several facts. You must determine if they have already happened or if they will occur.
Oh, I see.
Now, first, you are acquainted with a tall, red-haired man. He will marry you, or perhaps has already married you.
Yes, that's my husband.
Very well. Next, a friend, a woman of foreign birth, and a quarrel are indicated.
A foreigner?
That is correct.
But I don't know any foreign women.
Then she is yet to come.
Oh?
And someone of great importance to your life vanishes.
Of great importance vanishes. Oh, I know. Roger's going to Duluth next Tuesday. Yes, that must be it.
No, it is not your husband. A woman, small, dark, someone very close to you.
There never have been any important women in my life. Certainly none who disappeared suddenly.
This woman will.
Are you sure that it isn't a man?
The stars are always sure.
Very well. Is that all?
Yes. Except for one thing.
Well?
There is death in your horoscope.
Death?
Someone dies, and you are responsible.
Oh, I'm afraid
I don't... The stars reveal that you are going to kill a man.
I didn't believe a word of it. How could that little oily man in the dirty white turban sit there grinning, telling me that I was going to commit a murder? Oh, it was utterly ridiculous. Impossible. Mr. Aran, that's not true. You're trying to frighten me. I don't know why, but you are. That can't be in my horoscope. It just can't be.
The reading is completed, madame.
But you can't
be... The stars do not lie, madame. Good afternoon.
I was trembling as I walked through the dingy velvet curtains and out into the clean air of the street. But then, in the business of shopping, permanent waving, and matineeing, the horoscope slipped out of my mind. I didn't think about Mr. Arand again, or the little airless, incense-filled room, or the future he had foretold until nearly a week later. It was my bridge afternoon. Martha Perkins and I had been partners as usual, and the game had gone quite well. But as we got up to change tables, Martha turned to me, her eyes hard and glinting.
Are you deliberately trying to lose the game, Edith?
What are you talking about?
If you don't know, it's time you found out. Bridge is usually played according to rules, and a two-bit is considered forcing.
But I certainly gave a response.
Oh, really, Edith? I think that your playing is getting very tiresome. An incorrect bid is worse than no bid at all.
Well, I assure you, I'll be glad to get another partner.
That doesn't bother me a bit. As a matter of fact, I won't be able to play for a few weeks anyway. I'm going to Canada for the summer.
How nice.
Yes, isn't it? My mother and father live there. I'm going for a visit.
Oh? I didn't know your parents were Canadian.
I don't know what difference that makes. And if it's of any interest to you, I'm not an American citizen myself. Now, will you try to concentrate on the cards just a little bit, Edith? If it's not asking too much.
I don't know why, but the quarrel with Martha upset me. I was surprised to learn that she was a Canadian. For some reason, it seemed important. And then I remembered the horoscope, the first prediction, a quarrel with a foreign woman. Perhaps there was something to Mr. Arand and his stars. After a moment, I shrugged. Oh, it was too absurd. Canada isn't a foreign country, not really. And Arand was such a fake, nothing but a cheap fortune teller. The argument with Martha had been a coincidence. Just a coincidence. When I got home that night, Roger was waiting for me, sitting in the big chair in the living room. He was holding something in his hand and looked up sharply as I came into the room.
Hello, dear. You're late?
Roger! Whatever are you doing with a gun?
Cleaning it. The man at the store said one should always clean a new revolver before using it.
But what's it for?
You?
For me.
Well, I thought since I'm going away for a few days, you might need it. There have been so many robberies in this district lately, and I don't like the idea of your being alone here at night.
Roger, I won't be alone.
I'm afraid you will, dear. You see, Sarah left this evening.
Left?
Yeah. She just walked out, said something about her mother needing her, and that was all the explanation I got.
That doesn't seem possible.
Servants are all alike nowadays.
But Sarah was like a part of the family. She's been with us always, for years.
Well, what can you do about it? She's gone.
Strange. Not a bit like her to leave without warning us. I don't know what I'll do without Sarah. I really don't know.
Someone very close to you, of great importance in your life, vanishes.
Oh, no, it isn't possible. It's another coincidence.
What's the matter with you, Edith? What are you mumbling about?
Why, nothing, nothing at all, Roger. I was just a little stunned by Sarah's leaving.
Well, don't worry. You'll be all right. Now, here. I want to show you how to use this gun, just in case.
No, Roger, I won't touch it. I won't.
There's no reason to be afraid. If a person understands firearms, he's all right. People who don't know how to use them are the ones who always get hurt.
Don't you understand, Roger? I won't touch that gun.
Oh, now, don't be so childish, Edith. It can't bite you.
I don't want to kill anyone, Roger. Don't make me kill anyone. Please don't make me kill anyone.
What are you talking about?
Oh, I can't explain it, but I have a sort of premonition. A feeling that I might shoot somebody and kill them.
What utter nonsense, Edith.
Oh, yes, I know it is, but that's the way I feel. I can't help it.
Oh, very well. In any case, I'll just put the revolver on the table next to your bed. You won't have to touch it unless you need to.
But I don't want to.
And I don't want to hear any more about it. For heaven's sake, Edith, you're acting like a child. I'll forget that I ever mentioned a gun and stop being so silly.
At last, I persuaded myself to go to bed. I thought it was terribly late, and I knew it was when I heard the clock strike. I think I was just dozing off when something awakened me. I sat up suddenly, listening. Oh, it was just a dog. I relaxed again. Oh, no. Someone was on the front porch. I was sure of it. A prowler, a thief, or... I went over to the window and peered into the darkness. Yes, there was a figure below me. An ominous, frightening figure, and I had to keep him from breaking into the house. I don't remember taking the gun, but it was in my hand, and as I raised it, I seemed to hear the voice of the astrologer beating against my brain.
The stars reveal that you are going to kill a man. The stars reveal that you are going to kill a man.
I knew then that the stars had told the truth. My fingers closed over the trigger.
You think the story is over, don't you? But wait. Fate takes a hand. Wait for the unexpected. And now for the surprising conclusion of Horoscope, starring Miss Marjorie Reardon, a Hamilton Whitney production written by Robert Libbert and Frank Burt and directed by Frank K. Danzig.
The gun dropped from my nerveless fingers. And then, as the little acrid gray puffs of smoke circled upward, I rushed down the steps and out onto the porch. A man was crumpled on the floor. A man wearing a white turban that was slowly staining red. His breath came in short gulps and rattled with a dying sound. As a cloud drifted away from the moon, I saw the face of the person I had shot. It wasn't a thief. It was Mr. Arand.
Madame, I am so glad. So glad I have time to see you. I had to tell you...
Don't try to talk. I'll get a doctor.
No, please. It is too late. I knew you would be worried and frightened, madame. So I came to tell you not to be concerned. The stars do not say that you will kill anyone. I made a terrible mistake. I am so sorry. I read you the wrong horoscope.
Horoscope starred Miss Marjorie Reardon. Listen soon for another of your favorite motion picture stars in a drama of The Unexpected. This program was transcribed in Hollywood.
Did you notice here at the end that there's no mention of the supporting cast? This seems to be common for this show. Too bad. I'd like to know who did that not-so-spectacular impression of Peter Lorre. Coming up next is an episode of the CBS Radio Workshop, which originally aired on February the 17th of 1957. Is the classic story by Frederick Pohl and Cyril Kornbluth, The Space Merchants, in which Madison Avenue has run amok and rules the world. and the rules and conventions of advertising are the law of the land. This classic novel was written in 1952. It was originally published in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine as a serial entitled Gravy Planet, where it ran in three parts for June, July, and August of 1952. Cyril Kornbluth was a prolific writer and a genuinely charming eccentric who died young at the age of 34 in 1958 of a heart attack. Frederick Pohl is still with us in 2010, at the age of 90.
Radio Works Imagination, the theater of the mind. Today, The Space Merchants, Frederick Pohl's and C.M. Kornbluth's modern classic about the future when the wizards of high-pressure salesmanship take over. It's the story of Mitchell Courtney, a copy smith, star class with Fowler Shock and Associates, the biggest and greatest advertising firm of the future, and a tale of a rocket ride to Venus. As I rubbed depilatory soap on my face and waited for my beard to melt away, I switched on the news over the bathroom mirror. A funny little man whom I finally recognized as the president had given another speech last night. There was a shot of the Venus rocket, squat and silvery on the Arizona sands. The report of rioting in Panama, the Conti underground probably. Then the phone rang. Hello.
Chief, you're due at the office.
Can't you see I'm dressing?
Oof, why that time?
Never mind. Why are you phoning me?
Mr. Shawkins called a board meeting a half an hour early. He's going to name the head of the Venus Project today, so hurry.
Hester, do me a favor. Will you call my wife, Dr. Nevin? Make an appointment at noon for Walter J. Silver.
For who?
Walter J. Silver.
Are you crazy?
Well, she won't talk to me, Hester. Use the fake name. Maybe I can get in.
All right. Now get down here fast.
Down on Fifth Avenue, there wasn't a pedicab in sight. For a moment, I thought I had a Cadillac with two men peddling it, but somebody else got it. I did the best I could. I hopped aboard the rolling northbound sidewalk and found myself hemmed in by a milling, perspiring group of consumers. I got off at Shockin' Towers and rode the express elevator to our offices on the 182nd floor. By sheer luck, I'd just taken my seat with my fellow board members when Fowler Shockin walked in.
Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Shockin.
Now, sit down. I'm going to stand for a moment. I've just come back on the moon rocket, as you know. Want to stretch my legs.
How is our project on the moon, Mr. Shockin?
Gentlemen, I'm proud. And I'm humble when I say it's successful. The mining ventures are bringing the people here on Earth many of the metals our forefathers exhausted long ago. The colonists seem quite untouched by the Conti revolutionists. Only instances of Conti sabotage in the past week. Thank you. Now I'd like to hear some reports on our other projects. Industrial anthropology.
Well, I wish to report that according to the midnight indices, all primary schools east of the Mississippi are being fed our Fowler Shock and Package school lunches, soy burger, and regenerated steak. Now, these lunches are being packaged in our Star's alias Red, which means that in the future, these young consumers will be completely conditioned to buying everything packaged in our special color, Star's alias Red. They'll have no choice.
Magnificent, magnificent. Now, let's hear from point of sale.
Well, Mr. Shockin, sir, we have tested our latest beverage, Coffeeist, in 15 key cities.
Each sample of Coffeeus contains 3 milligrams of a simple alkaloid. Nothing harmful, but definitely habit-forming. After 10 weeks, the customer is hooked for life. A cure will cost $1,000, so it's easier to buy more Coffeeus. 3 cups with every meal and a hot jug beside the bed at night.
You know, gentlemen, on my trip back from the moon, I begin to wonder, are we getting soft?
No, sir, Mr. Shockhead.
Thank you, Matt. But I wonder, were we doing enough for our consumers? Those consumers sleeping out there on the stairways. I know how lucky they are being able to buy the wonderful goods we make, package and sell them. Seaweed suits, soya burger, regenerated steak, Coffeeus, straw butt cigarettes. But I still wondered, were we in the upper classes of advertising getting soft? But now I've decided Fowler Shock and Associates is not soft, that it's ready to meet a challenge greater than our organizing India into one giant cartel, greater than our development of the moon, the greatest challenge the world of advertising and promotion has ever met, the colonizing of Venus.
Shocking sense of the dramatic was never better. The touch of a button on the conference table before him, the lights were dimmed. Another touch of a button, and one wall of the room became a giant projection screen. We are looking at it again. The Venus rocket. But this time we knew that one of us would be named to head the Venus project.
There she stands, gentlemen, the Venus rocket, a 1,000-foot monster, surrounded now by steel scaffolding and aglow with welding torches. And here's how you'll see her 6 months from now, just before the takeoff. Just before the takeoff, there's the ship that Congress gave us, Fowler Shock and Associates. There's the ship that will span the stars. 6.5 million tons of trapped lightning and steel. A rocket-powered Mayflower for 1,800 pioneers seeking a new world to settle. Who will man it? Gentlemen, it's our job, A, to justify my buying enough congressmen to vote us that rocket. B, to sell 1,800 crazy consumers on giving up life on the Earth for the sulfur and nitrogen and canned life on Venus.
Yes, sir, Mr. Shocken. Yes, sir.
I've made my choice of the man to head up our Venus rocket project. His name is Mitchell Courtney.
Congratulations, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Terrific break for a young and experienced guy.
Yes, I'm flattered.
Fowler seemed to be sure he knew what he was doing.
He seemed to be sure.
Well, drop into my office any time you need advice.
Yeah, thanks. I'll keep my back to the wall.
Good luck with Venus Project, Mitch. As far as I'm concerned, you can't sell people on life in a sardine can, even if you throw in a slave girl as a premium.
Way, Mr. Silver. Dr. Nevins will see you now.
Dr. Nevins?
Mitch, how did you get in?
I used another name. I had to see you, Kathy. After all, you're my wife.
I am not your wife.
My certificate's on file.
Mine isn't. It never will be. As soon as this year is up, we're through.
Wait. I've got some news.
Well, what is it?
I've been put in charge of the Venus project at the agency.
Congratulations.
Oh, Kathy, I love you. I'm not above using this promotion as an excuse to celebrate. Won't you go out on the town with me tonight?
No.
Well, I promise not to make a scene. You're the only one I want to celebrate with.
All right, Mitch. My apartment at 7. And now let me take care of the sick people.
Outside Kathy's office, I hailed a 2-man Cadillac pedicab and told them to step on it to Shocken Towers. I took the express elevator to the top of the towers. I ran across the heliport to Shocken's private helicopter. I had
had a very important date out of New York's newest airport at Montauk. I was due to meet the Earth's number one celebrity, Jack O'Shea, the first and only man who would ever set a rocket down on Venus and return. As I landed, his jet was just coming in. And as I jumped to the ground, his jet moved up the runway toward me, and the place was crawling with women. I'd forgotten what a swath Jack had cut with the women on his cross-country lecture tours. In fact, I'd almost forgotten until his Pinkerton cards cleared away through the vast crowds. I'd almost forgotten that Jack was a midget. Welcome to New York, Jack.
Hello, Mitch. I hear you're number one boy now.
Well, I still work for Fowler Shockin, Jack, but the Venus rocket project is mine.
You're a fool to take it.
Oh, you're joking.
Am I? All right, fellas, Mr. Courtney's from Fowler's shop, and you can check off now.
Yes, sir, Mr. O'Shea.
Crummy guards. I never get a free moment.
Well, that's the penalty for being a celebrity. This way, Jack. Our helicopter's over here.
Hey, look out, Mitch. That cargo ship.
Darn fool pilot.
Run, Mitch. Run! Hey, Mitch. Mitch, you all right?
Yes, I'm okay. Thanks a lot.
Mitch, that was no accident. That pilot had orders to get one of us, and I think it was you.
I had to start pumping Jack O'Shea about Venus. Shockin was paying him a fat retaining fee as a consultant. Jack didn't seem to want to talk, however. I showed him projections, maps, drawings, charts. But he barely said a word worth recording on tape. Suddenly an idea hit me. I made a phone call.
Oh, Kathy, do you know that this is the first time I've laughed, really laughed, since I came back to Earth?
Is it, Jack? I'm complimented.
And that this is the first time I've been alone with two people since I came back?
I thought you'd had enough of being alone in that rocket on Venus.
It must have been a shattering experience, Jack.
Kathy, you're the first person who seems to have understood that. Not exciting. Not thrilling. It was frightening. Shattering, as you said. It wasn't at all like what I've told the women's clubs, the reporters. That's been a pack of lies. The atmosphere, for instance. It's really formaldehyde. Embalming fluid. Who'd understand that, except the dead? And the heat, who'd understand that? Who's lived in heat above the boiling point of water? If there was any water on Venus, which there isn't.
Why did you go, Jack?
That's easy. You're a doctor. You know about midgets. We eat one-third the food, drink one-third the liquids, inhale and exhale one-third the air full-size humans require. They'd never have gotten that test rocket to Venus if I hadn't been the size I am, if I hadn't been a child who's been laughed at, who'd turned test pilot to prove myself. I was so small they could pack me into that test rocket with all the equipment necessary to sustain me. 83 days. It takes a lot of equipment to sustain even a midget.
Six of those days were on Venus. What was it like, Jack?
I think the closest thing on Earth is the Painted Desert. The wind blows hard. It tears rocks apart. Soft rocks disappear and make dust storms. The light is funny. Nobody ever saw a light like that on Earth. Orangey, brownish light. Very, very bright. But threatening. And there's no water on Venus. No vegetation. No living thing.
In the quiet of Kathy's apartment, Jack O'Shea talked for another hour.
To keep your dog in top condition, get your pet complete nutrition. Feed them sturdy, make them sturdy, happy, friendly, pecky, furry. Any dog can be a winner if he eats some sturdy dinner. Feed them sturdy, beefy sturdy, vet with thanks, insist on sturdy. Ask any dog who's tasted it, the doggy with the bit. You sturdy dinner, dog food is delicious. Get sturdy.
No living thing.
In the quiet of Kathy's apartment, Jack O'Shea talked for another hour. Then suddenly, with hardly a word of goodbye, he stood up and walked out. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks for changing plans and letting me bring him.
Don't mention it, Mitch. Do you think you got it all on your little tape recorder?
You knew I had one in my pocket.
I was sure you would have. And I hope you play it back to yourself over and over and over.
Oh, Kathy.
Yes, over and over and over. Until even you were convinced how hopeless your Venus project is.
Hopeless? Oh, our science boys have answers to all those objections.
Mitch, doesn't that mind of yours ever stop selling somebody something? Do you have to be a contriving, selfish Machiavelli who served Fowler, Schocken, and never people?
People? You mean consumers?
Oh, Mitch, must you always be top dog? Making money, money, money without scruples, without ethics? What was that?
A gunshot.
Jack's out there.
Well, I'll go and see. Oh, he's all right. Those are his steps.
Mitch! Mitch, I was standing talking with a doorman and someone shot him in cold blood. Someone thought that doorman was you.
Well, Mitch, trouble with the Venus Project already?
Personal trouble, Mr. Schocken.
Personal trouble?
Yes, yesterday afternoon a cargo helicopter tried to drop its full load on me, and last night somebody tried to shoot me. I've had a couple of head-on collisions with Matt Runstead.
Are you accusing a Schocken man? That's treason. Killing an agency employee is an offense against the United States government. Any idea who's behind this?
No. Well, it might be the Concies, of course.
Well, conservationists hate us. They're trying to sabotage everything we want to do, but they're crazy, mixed up, unorganized. They want to go back to the old days when we had natural wood, natural water, all that sort of claptrap. Forget them.
Well, it could be another advertising agency.
It could be. But look, Mitch, I made you copysmith, star class, because I thought you could live up to your responsibilities. Now, you're young, but you have power. 5 words from you, and a few months later, 500 million consumers will find their lives completely changed. That's power. Absolute power. So you must remember, power has its compensation and its hazards. That's all.
With this encouragement, I continued work on the Venus Project for the next 6 weeks. I even talked Kathy into giving up her patience for 48 hours and taking a flying trip with me to Arizona. I wanted to get the feel of the giant rocket itself as it was being built.
Your credentials, please. Army intelligence, check. Navy intelligence, check. Air Force intelligence, check. FBI, check. AEC, check. CIA, check. 4A's, check. I hope you two are all right. This way, please.
Kathy and I followed the security officer into the vast steel shell of the Venus rocket.
1,257 feet high. More cubits than the average New York apartment building.
He took us into the dormitories for the 1,800 pilgrims I had to sell on the idea of going to Venus.
Closed cycle food, water, and air regeneration. One-third living space, one-third drive, one-third freight.
It was an inferno. And a promise of paradise. A monument to 22nd century engineering. And an incomparable monument to the sheer artistry of the machine.
Mitch. Do you always have to talk like a coppersmith?
Huh? Oh, I noticed you were impressed too, Kathy.
Well, it draws me and repels me. I can't explain it.
It excites me. Kathy, how'd you like to go on to San Diego with me?
Whatever for?
Well, Matt Runstead's boys in our San Diego office have been gathering test figures on our sample colonizing campaign. Very helpful.
No, I can't come, Mitch. I'd love to, but my patients back in New York need me.
Oh. Well, then I'll get you aboard the return jet and see you in New York in 48 hours. I didn't tell them I was coming to San Diego. I walked in on our entire San Diego staff playing push-button poker. What's the meaning of this?
Oh, who are you, mister?
Mitchell Courtney.
Well, it's Courtney from New York, fellas.
What are the reports on the Venus sampling, Harris?
There aren't any, sir.
Tally sheets, punch card codes, Sigma progress charts. Nothing on the attitudes of consumers toward life on Venus?
Well, nothing, sir. Nothing.
You've made up everything you've given me so far.
Well, I'm afraid so, sir.
Well, get New York on the line. I want Matt Runstead.
Well, he's not there.
Well, where is he?
Well, he called this morning. He's taken off for Little America to look after our interests there.
And left you holding the bag, huh? Find out when the next jet leaves for Little America. America is a dollar trap for the tourists of the world, conceived and promoted by Fowler Shockin. A clerk at our hotel told me Runstead had checked in for a two-day tour of the Starzalius Glacier, that he already had started out on the trail. I rented the glacier equipment, Antarctic coveralls, hood, gloves, boots, and power pack to warm them. And on my back, I had an EDF that went beep, beep when I was on the trail, and beep, beep when I lost my way in the snow. I set out after Runstead, beeping and still mad. I stopped after a while and cooked a meal in my electric pocket. It wasn't bad. Well, very bad. I had some coffee to pep me up, and then I set out again. My feet hit a drift, and I stumbled. The wind was blowing stronger now. The snow flurries were more frequent. I must have gone on another hour. How far in distance, I don't know. And then up ahead, I saw the figure of a man. Matt! Matt Runstead!
Matt! Matt Courtney!
Matt, I've been following you.
Me? What do you want with me, Matt?
I want to know what happened in the San Diego office. What are you up to, Matt? A sudden blast of wind hurled snow into my face, and then, as it cleared, I saw Matt raising his skis high above his head. I saw them coming down toward me as he pole-axed me.
The CBS Radio Workshop has brought you part one of The Space Merchants, adapted for radio by Charles Monroe, with original music composed and conducted by Samuel Matlofsky. Produced and directed in New York by Paul Roberts. Stotz Cotsworth starred as Mitch Courtney, Virginia Kay as Kathy. The sound effects were devised by Tom Buchanan and Tom Perkins, the engineer Jack Katz. This is Ted Pearson inviting you to join us next week for the second part of the CBS Radio Workshop production of The Space Merchants.
The CBS Radio Workshop has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
The second part aired on February the 24th of 1957. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to make you wait another week for part two. In fact, here it is now.
aboard a cargo jet in the 22nd century.
Here's a man we had trouble with in the hold, Lieutenant.
What's his complaint?
Well, he claims he's Mitchell Courtney, a copysmith star class of the Fowler's Shock and Advertising Company. He says he's been shanghaied aboard this jet.
Roll up his sleeve. Let's see his Social Security tattoo. 1304-9974-1416-156-187723. Liar! Get him out of here. If he's with Shock and Advertising, he'd have a low number.
Can't you see it's been altered? Let me use the radio and talk to Mr. Shocken himself.
Where from, Mr. Courtney? The dead? Take a look at this copy of today's New York Times, dated February 17th, 2157.
Mitchell Courtney, head of the Venus Rocket Project at the Fowler Shock and Advertising Firm, has been found dead in Little America. Now, wait a minute. A man by the name of Matt Lunstead knocked me out there. But can't you see that I'm alive? I am Mitchell Courtney.
You can prove that after 10 years.
10 years?
My manifest shows that you're not an advertising man. You're only a consumer named George Groby. You've signed up for 10 years labor in Costa Rica. And those 10 years begin as soon as this jet sets down. Take him back to the hold.
The CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. The CBS Radio Workshop continues part two of The Space Merchants by C.M. Kornbluth and Frederick Pohl. Today, the workshop resumes the story of Mitchell Courtney, copysmith star class with the world's greatest advertising agency of the future, Fowler Shock and Associates. The tale of a rocket ride to Venus.
I lay on my filthy bunk in the hold of the cargo jets, trying to think of a way to get back to New York. I wanted to find out why Matt Runstead had knocked me out and had me shanghaied. Who wanted to get me off the Venus Project, the advertising campaign we dreamed up to colonize Venus? I wanted to get back to my wife, Kathy. But there was nothing I could do until this cargo jet landed in Costa Rica.
Get in line. Now, what's your name?
Mitchell Courtney.
Mitchell Courtney. Oh, yeah. You're the bum we had trouble with on the plane.
Sorry, my name is George Groby.
Oh, that's better. What do you want to do here, Groby? Got any choice of job?
Anything. Anything the sun-drenched plantations of Costa Rica have to offer. I'm here to clasp the deft hands of independent farmers with pride in their work. I'm here to extract the juicy, ripe goodness of chlorella protein.
Say, how'd you learn that? That's our prime impact commercial.
Learn it. I wrote it. But don't let that stand in your way.
Groby, you're not going to get anywhere being a wise guy.
Yes, sir.
You're assigned as a chlorella scum skimmer third class. Report for duty and assignment to a bunk at Tier 48 in Dormitory Z.
Chlorella products is a strange, glutinous, ever-growing organism called Chicken Little. It provides one-third of the world with the protein that replaces old-fashioned meat. It grows in huge, sweating vats. And only the constant slicing keeps it from overgrowing and covering Costa Rica and its neighbors, or in time, the face of the earth. I had written of its delight many times in the agency, but I now came to know it firsthand. I was assigned to skim the scum which dripped from its side.
She stinks pretty bad, don't you, Jorge?
She's high, Herrera.
But she's beautiful, Chicken Little, eh, Jorge?
Well, she's pretty awful.
Jorge, this is the first time I ever hear you say the advertisements are wrong. Go into town with me tonight, eh, Jorge?
I'd made one friend, a master slicer named Herrera. He'd been aloof and standoffish at first, befitting his high station, but now he'd befriended me, done me a lot of favors. I didn't know why until that night we went on the town to a dark, almost empty cafe.
Jorge, I have watched you very carefully.
You don't belong here doing this work.
Well, don't I? How am I ever going to get out?
You have the brains, Jorge, not like the others.
Oh, thanks. What good are brains here? I'm so tired half the time I can't think.
Jorge, I'm going to put my life in your hands. Do you ever hear of the Concis?
The Concis, of course.
You know what the Concis stand for?
Sure, World Conservation Association.
I mean their ideas. Oh, I know you have heard they are dangerous.
They want a revolution. They want to go back to the old ways. Real meat, real grains and fruit. They want a break for the consumer, they say. Nothing in packages, nothing tested and guaranteed.
Do you think they are so wrong? After 6 months here? Here, Jorge, take this pamphlet. Read it. Then talk to me again, hmm? Or denounce me. I am not afraid.
The Consi Underground opposed everything a self-respecting 22nd century advertising man like me believed. I would have denounced Herrera to the Chlorella authorities the next day, except for one thing. If I joined the Consis first, if I learned their organization and secrets, I'd have a better bargaining position in getting back to New York. I joined them. Yeah, the irony was the Consis were a lot better organized than I'd suspected, and after 6 months, they decided they needed me in New York. And it was they who engineered my return to the city. I returned to New York on a secret mission for the Consis. 2 weeks after being in New York, I got the secret sign to attend a Consi meeting at the Metropolitan Museum. As my first taste of luxury in more than a year, I hailed a Cadillac pedicab and told the driver to take me to the Metropolitan Museum.
You can't do better than to visit the Metropolitan Museum, mister. World's greatest masterpieces. Don't miss the painting on the first floor. It's called I Dreamed I Was Ice Fishing in My Wonderform Bra.
Yeah, I read it brought $1.5 million.
Not a satellite. And don't miss the theatrical collection. It got dancing cigarettes. Say, you mind if we stop a second? These new Cadillac cabs are hard to pedal. Okay, get out.
Oh, no, you don't. What's the idea of the gun?
I recognize you when you walked out of Grand Central, Mr. Mitchell Courtney.
What do you want with me?
I want you to get out of the cab and come with me to the Taunton Agency. They've offered a big, fat, juicy reward for anybody who'll bring them the inside story of Fowler Schocken's Venus Rocket Project. And you're the boy who headed it up.
So you're the boys who shanghaied me and got me off the project.
No, we're not. I don't know who did. But we're sure glad we found you. The boy with all those nice secrets about colonizing Venus. Taunton wants those secrets. Come on, get out of here.
Drop the gun. Drop it or I'll break your neck. I grabbed the gun and hit him behind the ear. Then I ran across Fifth Avenue and lost myself in a group of consumers on the sidewalk rolling back toward Schocken Towers. I jumped off and ran to the express elevator. Down the corridor to Schocken's office. It was dark and deserted. Then down the corridor, I saw a light under my old office door. I walked up to it. And I didn't knock. Esther.
Mitch! Oh, no!
Esther, it's all right. I'm alive.
Oh, but Mitch, they said you were dead.
Who, Matt Lunstead?
Yes. Everyone believed him.
Did my wife, did Kathy believe him, Hester?
Yes.
Well, get her on the phone for me. Call her.
Well, she's disappeared, Mitch.
What?
No one's been able to find her. After the news of your death, she just closed her office and disappeared.
Maybe Schocken knows where she is. Where is Schocken, Hester?
Well, he caught the moon rocket yesterday morning. He was going over your notes on the Venus Project.
He's taking it over?
Yes, from Matt Rudenstedt. It was going bad.
I'll bet. Matt's trying to ruin our campaign. Hester, you've got to get me aboard the next moon rocket. Use the name George Proby. Brunstead and a Taunton agency will try to stop a man named Courtney. I've got a lot to tell, Mr. Schocken.
Thank you.
Passengers, this way, please. We are now on the moon. Tourists to the moon to the left. Visitors on business to the right. Now for a name.
George Grubby, copy analyst class 4.
Grubby, copy analyst 4. Oh. Guard. Yes. This way, please.
Yes, sir.
This man says his name is George Grubby.
Fine. You're under arrest, Grubby.
Let go of me. I'm here to see Fowler Dawkins.
Mr. Runstead down on the earth told us to expect you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You may be interested to know that your secretary, Miss Hester Barnes, is being tried for treason.
Treason?
She is charged with forging documents and passing them to you. The 43rd Amendment to the United States Constitution. Treason to any registered advertising agency is punishable by death. Hold him for the return passage in a similar charge, guard.
The guard had his nightstick in my back as we walked down the streets. Past storefronts with signs, moon-made fashions, stunning conversation pieces prove you were here. Souvenirs of Luna, cheapest in town. Moon suits rented, 50 years without a blowout. Ye tasty goody shop on ye moon. Warren Astron, readings by appointment only.
Hold it.
What is it?
You sure your name's Grovey?
Positive.
Ever know a man named Herrera?
Well, yes, Herrera and I...
Wish we could find out what you're up to, Grovey. Send out a Costa Rica to report in New York, never show up at a meeting there. Then you turn up at Fowler Shockin's agency and get your passage on a moon rocket.
You mean you're a...
Shut up! Now go into Astron's there. He'll hide you till our top boss up here comes. First take my nightstick and knock me out with it, then point it at the streetlight and blast it out. Hit me hard, but not too hard. Oh, this is going to cost me 2 strikes and a week's pay. Oh.
My Conti training was really paying off. Astron took me in stride, hid me in a room under his floor, gave me something to eat, and I fell asleep. I waked with a light pouring down into my face.
You can come up now, Groby. The chief is here to see you. In that room back there. I'll see you're not disturbed.
Thanks.
Over here, into the light, Mr. Grubby.
Kathy, what are you doing here?
Oh, Mitch, why didn't you stay on ice? What crazy thing have you done to turn up here?
Go on. I'm crazy. Why shouldn't I be crazy? My wife, a kingpin consi.
What a shock. You, a star-class copysmith, married to a consi.
Matt's one of you. You got Matt Runstead to Shanghai me.
Like a fool. I thought if I could get you away from Fowler Shockin, I might bring you to your senses.
Trying to decide what was best for poor little Mitch.
Mitch, I loved you.
You loved me? You actually were in love with me?
Yes, I was, in spite of everything you stood for. But you are not going to talk to Fowler Shockin.
I'm not.
Mitch, I don't want you to ruin Venus the way you've ruined the world.
A woman of ideals. What do you plan to do with me?
Are you going to report to Fowler Shockin?
Yes.
Then there is nothing I can do for you.
Then let me tell you something before you turn me over to Astron and your friends outside. I've been shanghaied, robbed of my name, forced to work like a slave in the tropics. I've had all I can take of others deciding what to do about poor old Mitch. Your guard friend left this nightstick with me. You know what it does, Kathy. Get on that phone and call Fowler Shockin and tell him where I am. Then get out. Take your friends with you. I'll give you 2 days to vanish. But this time, stay out of sight forever. Go on. Call Shockin.
This is Dr. Nevins, Mitchell Courtney's widow. I'd like to speak to Mr. Shockin, please.
Mitch, my boy, I'm going to fatten you up and turn Venus section back to you. You know my policy. Find a good horse, give him his head, and back him to the limit. You've never let me down. And Venus section's in rotten shape. Nobody's applying for space on the Venus rocket. The whole campaign's at sea. The indices are down to 3.37 for North America. They should be 4 and rising. We've got to get those 1,800 consumers on board the Venus rocket.
When we got back to Earth, Matt Runstead had disappeared. I arranged for Hester to be released from Alcatraz, and she returned in triumph in Shockin's private jet. I began to whip the Venus rocket project back into shape. I was living again, writing new jingles, starting new rumors by word of mouth, developing new techniques, until finally...
Mitch, the big day has come. 1,800 consumers have volunteered to ride our rocket to Venus. Now, I've arranged for Congress to meet tomorrow, and my boy, I want you to address them as Fowler Schocken's personal representative requesting a takeoff date.
Gentlemen, the Senate is now in session. You all received a recording of the opening prayer last night. So let's hear from the Senator from Chlorella Limited.
The Senator from Chlorella Limited passes in deference to the Senator from Alaska Mining.
The Senator from Alaska Mining passes in favor of the Senator from United Steel and Smelting.
The Senator from United Steel and Smelting passes in favor of the Senator from Caribbean Fruit.
The Senator from Caribbean Fruits passes in favor of the Senator from Yummy Cola.
My dear fellow senators, I thank you all for graciously allowing me to speak before we pass upon this very important bill concerning the Venus rocket. The people of this great republic of ours, extending from Atlantic seaweed to Pacific fish.
Suddenly I sensed something had gone wrong. I'd been sitting back thinking about Kathy, thinking of her face, her voice, her smile before we'd married. I was wondering where she was, what she thought of all this. Then the speaker's voice focused my attention upon him. I hadn't been worried. Fowler Schocken owned 2/3 of this gathering. But there was something about old Yummy Cola that troubled me. He wasn't addressing his fellows. He was looking up, addressing me. A big grin on his face. I leaned forward just in time for the weenie.
In a brief discussion I had before this session, Mr. Taunton gave me some information in private. But I feel it my public duty to ask a couple of questions of Mr. Courtney, who is present. I would like to ask Mr. Courtney if the name of George Groby is familiar to him. I would like to ask if Mr. Courtney is George Groby. I would like to ask Mr. Courtney if, when he was known as George Groby, he was a member in good standing of the World Conservationist Association, known to most of us loyal Americans as the Conti.
Below, there was a raging tidal wave of taunting congressmen and shocking congressmen battling. For the first time in history, shots were being fired in anger on the Senate floor. If Taunton hadn't tipped off old Yummy Cola, I knew who had. The conscience. Somehow I didn't mind. I realized that for some time now, I'd really been one of them. A little man beside me, dressed in black, suddenly seized my arm and led me out the side door.
You'll find a car outside, ready to take you to the airport, Mr. Courtney.
What airport?
Don't stop to ask questions. Just go wherever you're taken. You'll be protected.
Fat chance.
You'll be all right, I guarantee that.
Who are you?
The president. Good luck. God bless you.
I had to admire that little man's courage. He'd walked back into that raging den of lions without a quiver. Aboard the jetliner, I wondered what would happen to him when they found out he'd sent me to safety. Or was it to safety? I tried to ask questions of the men aboard the liner, but they looked the other way and kept absolutely quiet.
You can climb out now, Mr. Courtney. They're all ready for you over there at the Venus rocket. There's no time to lose.
Say, look here, I don't want to go to Venus. Who's in charge here? I won't go aboard that rocket.
Everybody's aboard but you. Come on, Mr. Courtney. In you go.
Last passengers, fasten them in for the takeoff.
Last passengers, ready for the takeoff.
Ladies and gentlemen, the chief hope of our enemies is to divide the United States along racial and religious lines and thereby conquer us. Let's not spread prejudice. A divided America is a weak America. Through our behavior, we encourage the respect of our children and make them better neighbors to all races and religions. Remind them that being good neighbors has helped make our country great and kept her free. Thank you.
Who's in charge here? I won't go aboard that rocket.
Everybody's aboard but you. Come on, Mr. Courtney. In you go.
Last passenger, fasten them in for the takeoff.
Last passenger, ready for the takeoff.
Cassie, where are you?
Up here, over your head.
Stop floating around. Come down here and unfasten me.
All right, I'll try. But we're beyond the law of gravity. We're on the way to Venus with 1,800 conservationists.
How did you get out of a harness?
A steward set me free, then floated away.
I have to talk to you.
Me? You threatened to kill me, remember?
Yes, I remember.
You could have, Mitch, in time. But you never told Shocken who or where I was. Why didn't you?
Because I love you, Kathy. And I think that for a long time I've been coming over to your side.
And you're willing to face life on Venus?
Yes. It's time people got a break.
People, not consumers. Oh, I like hearing you say that. And I love you too, Mitch. Oh, Mitch. Mitch, you broke my hold on your harness.
Come back here. I just wanted to put my arms around you.
Oh, there'll be plenty of time for that on Venus.
Come back here.
Unbuckle your harness and catch me.
I can't. Who invented this crazy gimmick anyway?
Oh, Mitch. Mitch, you've stopped talking like an advertising man. Kiss me.
The CBS Radio Workshop has presented Part 2 of The Space Merchants, adapted for radio by Charles S. Monroe. Original music composed and conducted by Samuel Matlofsky. Produced and directed in New York by Paul Roberts.
The CBS Radio Workshop has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Next, we have an excursion into the haunting hour. Don't know why they called it the haunting hour. It's only 30 minutes long. Seems to me like that'd be the haunting half hour. But, you know, that doesn't really have the ring of the haunting hour. Tonight's episode, Nocturne, is from August the 3rd of 1945. I wish I could tell you more about that, but this is one of those shows, of which there are many in old-time radio, that have survived more or less intact, but without any information to build a provenance on. We don't know who produced it. We don't know who starred on it. We don't know what network it ran on. It was just one of those finds that old-time radio aficionados sometimes stumble on. I don't know the exact history of this, but I'd be willing to bet that at some point somebody just came across this stack of old transcription records, and now we have it.
Thank you. No. No, stay where you are. Do not break the stillness of this moment. For this is a time of mystery. A time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is the Haunting Hour. Exceedingly strange is this world, and of all the things in it, the strangest are the ways of men. There are those who harbor up bitterness, along whose network of nerves, taut as fiddle strings, lurks the primordial passion which branded Cain. And there are those whose thoughts are like lighted shadows against the stars, and the fiber of whose individuality throbs to beauty and the revelation of music. This is the story of two men, and of the role a piece of music and a searing flame played in their destiny. Two men, Matt and Stuart Bannock, twin brothers held together by the tenuous cobweb of blood ties, but poles apart in the warp of their lives. Matt, brooding and neurotic. Stuart, teeming with vigor, brilliant as a shaft of morning sunlight. That is Stuart playing.
You're always playing that infernal piece. Why, Stuart, why?
Matt, you've asked me that before. I like it. It's my favorite. You'd understand if you were a musician.
That's right. Rub it in. You're a musician, I'm not. I can't play a note.
Matt.
So you're talented and I'm not.
I didn't mean it that way.
You're admired by everyone and I'm not. And no matter what you meant. The fact is, I'm just a forgotten half of twin brothers. Everything conspires against me.
Matt. Come on, you just haven't found yourself yet, that's all.
Haven't found myself. I find that I've been robbed.
Robbed?
Yes, my dear Stuart, robbed. And apparently there's nothing I can do about it.
What are you talking about?
Nothing.
But Matt, you've never said anything to me about it. When did it happen?
When we were born.
Afraid I don't follow you.
That's the trouble. I followed you. You were born first, ahead of me.
Sure, by all of 10 minutes, but what of it? I don't see that that means anything.
Oh, naturally, you wouldn't. Those who ride never understand why those who walk are footsore. Those who possess don't understand the hunger of those in want.
Matt, you're talking in riddles. What are you trying to say?
I say you're a robber, a thief.
I?
Yes, you, my own twin brother. You're stolen from me.
Matt, I don't understand. What have I taken from you?
Talent. Personality. Intangible things that mark the difference between one man and another.
Talent. Personality. Afraid I'm confused. I don't know what you're talking about.
Did you ever wonder why people have no trouble telling us apart?
No, I can't say that I have.
Look. Here we are, twins. Identical twins. We look alike in every respect. Yet no one ever calls you Matt or me Stuart. Do you know why?
Why?
Because they can sense the difference between us, that's why. Because the man who has and the man has not. Oh, don't look so amazed, Stuart. It's true. You're the one who has, and I'm the one who has not. And the things I lack are the qualities you have in overabundance. Strength. Imagination. Vigor and talent, all the things that you've robbed from me.
Matt, you're not making sense.
Oh, yes, I am. I thought it all out carefully. I've had years to do it, Stuart. Now I know.
Now you know what?
that a person is born with just so much luck or strength or talent. With twins, it has to be divided. There isn't quite enough of everything to go around, so one twin takes more than his fair share. He robs the other, just as you've robbed me, Stuart.
What a theory, Matt.
It's a fact. A fact from which there can be only one escape for me.
Mavis?
Yes, Matt?
Well, that is, you look very lovely today.
Oh, thank you, kind sir.
Well, you're always beautiful.
Such flattery.
It isn't flattery. You know I mean it. Mavis, you know how I feel about you.
Please, Matt. We've gone all through that before.
I can't help it, Mavis. I love you. I'd do anything for you. I'd even kill for you.
Matt!
Yes, I'd kill for you. I can't stand the thought of some other man possessing you. I tell you, I won't allow it.
Please, please, Matt. You're all excited.
Well, why shouldn't I be? You expect me to stand by and do nothing while another man steals all the things that I want?
No one is taking anything from you, Matt. I just don't love you. That's all.
Tell me the truth, Mavis. Is there someone else?
Yes.
I thought so. I thought so. He always stands in the way of my happiness.
He? But I haven't said who it is.
You don't have to. I know.
Well, then you must be psychic.
Don't joke, Mavis. It isn't funny. Not to me.
I'm sorry.
Everyone is always sorry for me. Poor Matt, they say. He's not at all like Stuart, his twin brother. Oh, poor Matt. Isn't it too bad he isn't a musician, too? Oh, poor Matt.
Oh, Matt, please.
It's Stuart you love, isn't it?
I didn't say.
You don't have to. I can see it in your eyes. Why are you afraid to tell me?
I don't know. Maybe it's because of what I see in your eyes. I'll tell you what. I'll make you a promise. As soon as the news of my engagement is ready to be released, you'll be the first to know.
Thanks.
No. Now you feel like killing anyone?
Yes, more than ever. Mavis?
Yes, Stuart?
Well, that is, you look very lovely today.
Thank you, kind sir.
But then you're always beautiful. Mavis, what's the matter? You look faint.
Oh, it's nothing. I just remembered something that someone else said.
You mean there are others crazy enough to think you're beautiful, too?
So I've been led to believe.
I thought I was the only one.
You are the only one.
Oh, Mavis, Mavis, darling. I love you.
And I love you.
Oh, this is wonderful. You're wonderful. Everything's wonderful. I want to tell the whole world about us.
Oh, but I promised to let someone be the first to know.
Who is it? Anyone I know?
It's a, Stuart.
Hmm?
You will be careful, won't you?
Careful? Careful of what, dear?
Of, it's nothing. I guess I'm just being silly.
No, you're adorable. Come here. Still feel silly?
No. Oh, but, Stuart, darling.
Yes, dear?
Do be careful. For my sake, please.
Who's there? I said, who's there?
It's I.
Oh, Matt. Had me worried for a moment. I didn't know who it was. Guess I'm kind of nervous tonight. Mavis said something about being... Well, Matt. Matt, what's that you're carrying?
A bottle.
What's in it?
A liquid.
A what?
Gasoline. Matt!
Matt, what's the big idea? See this match in my hand? Sure. That ought to give you your answer. Matt, that's dangerous. For you, not for me. What are you saying? You won't rob me this time, Stuart. You've taken talent and personality from me. Now you want the girl I love.
But
I can't stand the thought of some other man possessing Mavis, I tell you, and I won't allow it. That I didn't know. Well, you do now! I'm going to set the house on fire, and you're going to be burned alive, dear brother.
Matt.
You can't get out! The flames will have you trapped there in the corner, but I can get out. I'm standing here by the door. Matt! Matt, don't strike that match! Goodbye, Stuart! I'm paying you back for robbing me.
Matt,
all I have to do is throw the burning match into the liquid at your feet. Like this.
Oh, my face. Explode in my face. I can't see.
Matt! Matt!
Stop!
Matt,
Matt,
where are you?
Stop!
Don't save me!
I can't!
Save me!
Matt, I'm cornered!
Stop! Matt!
Brothers, yet different as day and night. Matt, bitter and neurotic. Stuart, a brilliant pianist whose favorite music is one of Chopin's nocturnes. Both are in love with Mavis, who loves Stuart. Matt believes he has been robbed of talent and personality by being born a twin. He sets fire to the Bennick house to kill Stuart, but he too is trapped in the flames. One man leaps from the burning building. Which is it? Matt or Stuart?
And the chief says there's no doubt it was a case of arson.
That so?
Yep. We found the fellow who sold the gasoline. He swears it was Matt Bannock who bought it.
He's positive, huh?
Yep. Says he knew both Stuart and Matt all their lives. Has never mistaken one for the other.
Makes the case pretty easy then, doesn't it, Kelly?
Bain, how long you been on the arson squad?
Oh, about 2 months.
Well, Bain, when you've been on it as long as I have, you'll know there's no such thing as a really easy case.
We've got the survivor, haven't we?
Yep. Get him under guard in the hospital.
Then all we have to do is identify him. What's so tough about that?
Oh, nothing. Nothing at all. Except the guys were identical twins and this fellow's badly banged up. And nobody knows whether it's Matt or Stuart.
No way of identifying him. By fingerprints or something?
No, we've checked everywhere. The prints have never been filed.
Well,
Yeah, go on, I'm listening.
Oh, why can't we get him to talk and identify himself?
We've tried that. He talks all right. He'll talk your arm off if you let him. But getting him to make sense, that's a different story.
Mavis. Mavis?
Yes?
I want Mavis. I love Mavis. Will you tell her that when you see her?
Yes, I'll tell her.
Make her come to me. Without her, I'm lost and everything is wasted.
Oh, try to rest, please.
You're not like Mavis.
Shh, shh. Now, you must be quiet so you can get well.
Shall I tell you a secret? I love her. Everybody loves her, but I love her most.
She loves you, too.
How do you know? Who told you? Go away. Tell Mavis I want her.
I'll bring her to you if you just go to sleep. And when you wake, she'll be here beside you.
Tell her I love her. I'll sleep if you promise to tell Mavis I love her.
Yes. Yes, I promise. Now, close your eyes.
And that's why we can't get him to identify himself. He doesn't talk sense. His mind's deranged.
I see.
Well, you got any more brilliant ideas on how we can find out if he's Matt or if he's Stuart?
Well,
go on, I'm still listening. I got nothing else to do.
Have you asked the doctors at the hospital how long it'll be before he recovers his senses?
Of course we asked the doctors. That's one of the first things we did when we found we couldn't get anything out of the man ourselves.
What'd they say?
Oh, they were very helpful. Very helpful indeed. They said as far as they could tell, he might be like that the rest of his life.
Gee, that's tough.
And then again, he might snap out of it at any time. A shock or something might restore his mind to normal.
That gives us some hope. See, Kelly, do you mind if I go along with you the next time you go to the hospital to see him?
No, not at all, not at all. What have I got to lose? There it is. 802. This is room.
Wasted, I tell you. She won't let it. She won't let it. She's good.
Listen to
me. She won't. It's dark most of the time. Lights go out. She makes it bright again.
That gives me the creeps.
Tell her to make it bright again. Tell
Hello.
Her.
Hello.
Someone's here.
How are you feeling?
I don't know you. Who are you?
Oh, just a couple of friends. Who are you?
You wouldn't understand. It's the darkness, but she makes
Listen,
it bright.
Poor devil.
She's Mavis, and I...
You're Matt.
I...
You're Matt, aren't you?
I'm Matt.
Huh?
I'm tired.
But you are Matt Bannock. We know that now.
I love Mavis.
Stop bluffing. You're Matt Bannock. You know you are.
I know I am. I am Matt Bannock. Yes. Yes, I am Matt Bannock. I'm Matt Bannock, and I've been robbed. Mavis makes the darkness bright.
Stop that. Now repeat after me. I am Matt Bannock. Go on, say it.
It's no use being this cracked.
I think he's faking. What's your name?
I'm Stuart Bannock. I'm Stuart Bannock, and I have everything because
What's your name?
I'm Matt Bannock. I'm Matt. I've been robbed of my head.
What's your name?
I love Mavis. I love Mavis because she makes everything right.
Why, give up. He's
I love her.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
I love Mavis.
Well, Matt Bannock or Stuart Bannock, whichever he is leaving the hospital today.
Yeah.
Girl Mavis is taking him to her home.
Why?
Well, it seems she and Stuart became engaged the very day of the fire. She doesn't know whether this fellow is Matt or Stuart, but she isn't taking any chances. You know how loyal women can be.
Yeah.
I'd like to forget the whole case, but the chief won't stand for that. He won't rest or let us rest till he proves who the survivor is.
Yeah. But even if he is Matt, we can't get a conviction. The man is mentally unbalanced.
Or else he's putting on a darn good act. And an act always has a flaw that shows up in time. But whatever it is, he's still getting away with murder.
You're home now. This is your new home.
Home?
Yes.
I am home.
Yes. This is where you'll get well and strong again.
Strong? I will be strong again.
You see? You've spoken two rational sentences in succession.
Home.
Maybe the association of ideas and objects will help. Come along. Come along with me. That's it.
I like to be home. I like to be home.
Now, sit right down here. Look what's in front of you. See? It's a piano.
Piano?
Yes, a piano. Play it. Play the piano.
Piano.
Watch me. See? Like this. Now you do that.
Piano.
Here. Let me help you. Put your hands on the keys. Like this. Now play. Please.
Piano.
Please try. Try again. Drink this glass of milk.
If you see Mavis, you tell her I love her.
Yes, I'll tell her. But first, take this glass. There, that's better. Oh, I'm so sorry for you.
Everyone is always sorry for me.
What?
I don't want to drink this. I'm tired. I'm tired of this.
Oh, you sound like Mavis.
Tired of them all. Robbed. Robbed of talent and personality.
Oh, no, it can't be.
I said robbed.
Don't wave your arm like that. You're allowed to upset the table.
I can't stand the thought of some other man possessing Mavis.
That's worse.
Robbed.
He said that the day you...
I won't allow it.
Oh, be careful of that table. There's a burning chafing dish on it.
I tell you, I won't allow it.
Oh, the table. Now you've overturned it.
I won't allow it.
The rug.
I won't.
The rug is on fire. It's on fire. Get out of the way. Get out of the way while I put out the fire. Stand over there. Stand over there by the piano. There. There, the fire is out. Do you hear? The fire is out.
Fire? Fire?
Don't come near me. Stay there by the piano. Yes, yes, by the piano.
Piano. Piano. Fire.
Exceedingly strange is this world, and of all the things in it, the strangest are the ways of men. This is the story of two men, and of the role a piece of music and a searing flame played in their destiny. Two men, Matt and Stuart Bennett, twin brothers, held together by the tenuous cobweb of blood ties, but poles apart in the warp of their lives. Matt, brooding and neurotic. Stuart, teeming with vigor, brilliant as a shaft of morning sunlight. From shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubts and fears. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory in the haunting hour.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock. 9, 13, 14, 17, or just a minute.
Or to hell with it.
I thought it might be appropriate here to have a short story by Kornbluth or Frederick Pohl. I wasn't really able to find a suitable reading of a short story by Cyril Kornbluth, but I was able to find several by Frederick Pohl and settled on Pythias, which was originally published in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine in February of 1952.
Pythias by Frederick Pohl. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Greg Marguerite. Pythias by Frederick Pohl. Sure, Larry Connaught saved my life, but it was how he did it that forced me to murder him. I am sitting on the edge of what passes for a bed. It is made of loosely woven strips of steel, and there is no mattress, only an extra blanket of thin olive drab. It isn't comfortable, but of course they expect to make me still more uncomfortable. They expect to take me out of this precinct jail to a district prison and eventually to the death house. Sure, there will be a trial first, but that's only a formality. Not only did they catch me with a smoking gun in my hand and Connaught bubbling to death through the hole in his throat, but I admitted it. I, knowing what I was doing with, as they say, malice aforethought, deliberately shot to death Lawrence Connaught. They execute murderers, so they mean to execute me, especially because Lawrence Connaught had saved my life. Well, there are extenuating circumstances. I do not think they would convince a jury. Connaught and I were close friends for years. We lost touch during the war. We met again in Washington a few years after the war was over. We had, to some extent, grown apart. He had become a man with a mission. He was working very hard on something, and he did not choose to discuss his work, and there was nothing else in his life on which to form a basis for communication. And, well, I had my own life, too. It wasn't scientific research in my case. I flunked out of med school, while he went on. I'm not ashamed of it. It is nothing to be ashamed of. I simply was not able to cope with the messy business of carving corpses. I didn't like it. I didn't want to do it. And when I was forced to do it, I did it badly. So I left. Thus, I have no string of degrees, but you don't need them in order to be a Senate guard. Does that sound like a terribly impressive career to you? Of course not. But I liked it. The senators are relaxed and friendly when the guards are around, and you learn wonderful things about what goes on behind the scenes of government. And a Senate guard is in a position to do favors for newspaper men who find a lead story useful, for government officials who sometimes base a whole campaign on one careless, repeated remark, and for just about anyone who would like to be in the visitors' gallery during a hot debate. Larry Connaught, for instance. I ran into him on the street one day, and we chatted for a moment, and he asked if it was possible to get him in to see the upcoming foreign relations debate. It was. I called him the next day and told him I had arranged for a pass, and he was there watching eagerly with his moist little eyes when the secretary got up to speak, and there was that sudden unexpected yell, and the handful of Central American fanatics dragged out their weapons and began to change American policy with gunpowder. You remember the story, I suppose. There were only three of them, two with guns, one with a hand grenade. The pistol men managed to wound two senators and a guard. I was right there talking to Connaught. I spotted the little fellow with the hand grenade and tackled him. I knocked him down, but the grenade went flying, pin pulled, seconds ticking away. I lunged for it. Larry Connaught was ahead of me. The newspaper stories made heroes out of us both. They said it was miraculous that Larry, who had fallen right on top of the grenade, had managed to get it away from himself and so placed that when it exploded no one was hurt. For it did go off, and the flying steel touched nobody. The papers mentioned that Larry had been knocked unconscious by the blast. He was unconscious, all right. He didn't come to for 6 hours, and when he woke up he spent the next whole day in a stupor. I called on him the next night. He was glad to see me. "That was a close one, Dick," he said. "Take me back to Tarawa." I said, "I guess you saved my life, Larry." "Nonsense, Dick. I just jumped. Lucky, that's all." "The papers said you were terrific. They said you moved so fast nobody could see exactly what happened." He made a depreciating gesture, but his wet little eyes were wary. Nobody was really watching, I suppose. I was watching, I told him flatly. He looked at me silently for a moment. I was between you and the grenade, I said. You didn't go past me, over me, or through me, but you were on top of the grenade. He started to shake his head. I said, also, Larry, you fell on the grenade. It exploded underneath you. I know, because I was almost on top of you, and it blew you clear off the floor of the gallery. Did you have a bulletproof vest on? He cleared his throat. Well, as a matter of... Cut it out, Larry. What's the answer? He took off his glasses and rubbed his watery eyes. He grumbled. Don't you read the papers? It went off a yard away. Larry, I said gently, I was there. He slumped back in his chair, staring at me. Larry Connaught was a small man, but he never looked smaller than he did in that big chair, looking at me as though I were Mr. Nemesis himself. Then he laughed. He surprised me. He sounded almost happy. He said, well, hell, Dick, I had to tell somebody about it sooner or later. Why not you? I can't tell you all of what he said. I'll tell you most of it, but not the part that matters. I'll never tell that part to anybody. Larry said, I should have known you'd remember. He smiles at me ruefully, affectionately. Those bull sessions in the cafeterias, eh? Talking all night about everything. But you remembered. You claimed that the human mind possessed powers of psychokinesis, I said. You argued that just by the mind, without moving a finger or using a machine, a man could move his body anywhere instantly. You said that nothing was impossible to the mind. I felt like an absolute fool saying those things. They were ridiculous notions. Imagine a man thinking himself from one place to another. But I had been on that gallery. I licked my lips and looked to Larry Connaught for confirmation. I was all wet, Larry laughed. Imagine. I suppose I showed surprise because he patted my shoulder. He said, becoming sober, sure, Dick, you're wrong, but you're right all the same. The mind alone can't do anything of the sort. That was just a silly kid notion. But, he went on, but there are, well, techniques linking the mind to physical forces, simple physical forces that we all use every day, that can do it all, everything, everything I ever thought of, and things I haven't found out yet. Fly across the ocean? In a second, Dick. Wall off an exploding bomb? Easily. You saw me do it. Oh, it's work. It takes energy. You can't escape natural law. That was what knocked me out for a whole day, but that was a hard one. It's a lot easier, for instance, to make a bullet miss its target. It's even easier to lift the cartridge out of the chamber and put it in my pocket so that the bullet can't even be fired. Want the crown jewels of England? I could get them, Dick. I asked, can you see the future? He frowned. That's silly. This isn't how about reading minds? Larry's expression cleared. Oh, you're remembering some of the things I said years ago. No, I can't do that either, Dick. Maybe someday, if I keep working at this thing. Well, I can't right now. There are things I can do, though, that are just as good. Show me something you can do, I asked. He smiled. Larry was enjoying himself. I didn't begrudge it to him. He had hugged this to himself for years, from the day he found his first clue through the decade of proving and experimenting, almost always being wrong, but always getting closer. He needed to talk about it. I think he was really glad that at last someone had found him out. He said, show you something. Why, let's see, Dick. He looked around the room, then winked. See that window? I looked. It opened with a slither of wood and a rumble of sash weights. It closed again. The radio, said Larry. There was a click, and his little set turned itself on. Watch it. It disappeared, and reappeared. It was on top of Mount Everest, Larry said, panting a little. The plug on the radio's electric cord picked itself up and stretched toward the baseboard socket, then dropped to the floor again. No, said Larry, and his voice was trembling. I'll show you a hard one. Watch the radio, Dick. I'll run it without plugging it in. The electrons themselves... He was staring intently at the little set. I saw the dial light go on, flicker, and hold steady. The speaker began to make scratching noises. I stood up, right behind Larry, right over him. I used the telephone on the table beside him. I caught him right beside the ear, and he folded over without a murmur. Methodically, I hit him twice more, and then I was sure he wouldn't wake up for at least an hour. I rolled him over and put the telephone back in its cradle. I ransacked his apartment. I found it in his desk, all his notes, all the information, the secret of how to do the things he could do. I picked up the telephone and called the Washington police. When I heard the siren outside, I took out my service revolver and shot him in the throat. He was dead before they came in. For you see, I knew Lawrence Connaught. We were friends. I would have trusted him with my life. But this was more than just life. 23 words told how to do the things that Lawrence Connaught did. Anyone who could read could do them. Criminals, traitors, lunatics. The formula would work for anyone. Lawrence Connaught was an honest man and an idealist, I think. But what would happen to any man when he becomes a god? Suppose you were told 23 words that would let you reach into any bank vault, peer inside any closed room, walk through any wall. Suppose pistols could not kill you. They say power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And there can be no more absolute power than the 23 words that can free a man of any jail or give him anything he wants. Larry was my friend, but I killed him in cold blood, knowing what I did, because he could not be trusted with the secret that could make him king of the world. But I can. End of Pythias by Frederick Pohl.
Okay, well, that does it for the prose portion of Night Transmissions. If you've been listening for a while, you know that I'm going to play some music now. And I will, before I go away, remind you that you can write me, and I sure wish you would,
at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender. Who is reaching for the sky just to surrender. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And then leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I came I was a stranger. But now another stranger seems to want you to ignore his dreams as though they were the burden of some other. Oh, you've seen that man before, his golden arm dispatching cards, but now it's rusted from the elbow to the finger. And he wants to trade the game he plays for shelter. Yes, he wants to trade the game he knows for shelter. Oh, you hate to watch another tired man lay down his hand like he was giving up the holy game of poker. And while he talks his dreams to sleep, you notice there's a highway that is curling up like smoke above his shoulder. It's curling just like smoke above his shoulder. You tell him to come in, sit down, but something makes you turn around. The door is open, you can't close your shelter. You try the handle of the road, it opens. Do not be afraid, it's you, my love, you who are the stranger. It is you, my love, you who are the stranger. Well, I've been waiting, I was sure we'd meet between the trains we're waiting for. I think it's time to board another. Please understand, I never had a secret chart to get me to the heart of this or any other matter. Well, he talks like this, you don't know what he's after. When he speaks like this, you don't know what he's after. Let's meet tomorrow if you choose upon the shore, beneath the bridge that they are building on some endless river. Then he leaves the platform for the sleeping car that's warm. You realize he's only advertising one more shelter. And it comes to you, he never was a stranger. And you say, okay, the bridge or someplace later. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I came I was a stranger. I told you when I came I was a stranger. I told you when I came I was a stranger.
It's a strange, strange world we live in, Master Jack. He taught me all I know and I'll never look back. It's a very strange world and I thank you, Master Jack. You took a dirty ribbon from out of the sky and taught me how to use it as the years went by. Tie up all your problems and make them believe, and then to sell them to the people in the street. It's a strange, strange world we live in, Master Jack. You taught me all I know and I'll never look back. It's a very strange world and I thank you, Master Jack. I saw right through the way you started teaching me now. So someday soon you can get to use me somehow. I thank you very much, you know you've been very kind. But I live alone before you change my mind. It's a strange, strange world we live in, Master Jack. No hard feelings if I never come. It's a very strange world and I thank you, Master Jack. You taught me all those things the way you'd like them to be, but I'd like to see a better people agree. It's all very interesting the way you disguise, but I'd like to see the world through my own eyes. It's a strange, strange world we live in, Master Jack.
But now, my love, now that you've left me, how can I live through another day? Watching my dreams turn into ashes and my hopes into bits of clay. Once I could see, once I could feel, now I am numb, I've become unreal. I walk the night now, my love. Now that it's over, I feel the world closing in on me. Here come the stars tumbling around me. There's the sky where the sea should be. What now, my love? Now that you're gone, I'd be a fool to go on and on. No one would care, no one would cry if I should live or die. Now there
The days of wine and roses laugh and run away like a child at play through the meadowland toward a closing. That wasn't there before. The lonely night discloses just a passing breeze filled with memories of the golden smile that introduced me to the days of wine and roses and you. Of the golden smile that introduced me to the days of wine.